This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Everyone here at the LenSec and listening on KUNM Radio, welcome to the Lannan Foundation's Readings and Conversations tonight featuring Chalmers Johnson. It is a great privilege to be able to introduce Professor Chalmers Johnson tonight. I come from New York, where we just finished covering the Republican National Convention. The day before the convention was held at Madison Square Garden, the largest mass protest in the history of U.S. political conventions took place outside. Half a million people marched against war. I have to say, I think it was as strong a message for John Kerry as for George Bush. And yet, where was the magnitude of this moment expressed in the mainstream media? 2 days later, on Tuesday, in the midst of the convention, more than 1,000 people were arrested, the largest mass arrest in the history of New York City, one of the largest mass arrests in the history of this country. By Thursday, almost 2,000 people had been arrested, and these were peaceful, nonviolent dissenters, expressing the finest traditions in this country, the belief that we can accomplish great things when we do them peacefully, when we don't resort to war because we can't afford war in the 21st century. Yet 2,000 people in jail. It got so extreme just hours before President Bush spoke inside that a judge ruled that if the city did not release the protesters, clearly being held so that they would not be able to protest as George Bush was speaking, if the city did not release the protesters, it would be fined $1,000 for each protester held. And yet, where was the coverage comparable to the event? We continue to get in the media the same small circle of pundits who know so little about so much. Where are the people like Chalmers Johnson being interviewed, sharing his expertise? Yes, truly an expert in every sense of the word, even in theirs. Here is a man who served in the military. He is from the inside as well as the outside. He worked as a consultant for the Central Intelligence Agency during the Vietnam War, had top security clearance, also had Q clearance at Sandia. Yes, this is a person who is a self-confessed cold warrior, was, and was proud of it at the time, a professor, University of California, Berkeley, then moved on to San Diego. You would think this is the kind of person that the media would love to interview. But over time, Chalmers Johnson's views changed, And I do believe that's what ices him out of the media, like so many others. And yet that is what makes him the great intellect and expert that he is, that he changes, that he learns, he takes in the world. I think the Republican juggernaut calls it flip-flopping, but I would call it wisdom. And I'm not trying to make any parallels here between Chalmers Johnson and the so-called opposition candidate. But it is so important that we start hearing from voices like Chalmers Johnson. His latest book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, is his 16th book. It is part of the American Empire Project, a very, very important book. And on Democracy Now!, it has been a great privilege to be able to turn to Chalmers to get his view on what is happening now with Japan, on what is happening with Iraq. Chalmers Johnson, who's written more than 16 books, has written extensively articles, has written a great deal about China, has done a lot with PBS, the TV series The Pacific Century, as well as the PBS Frontline documentary Losing the War with Japan. Maybe he can help save PBS as well. If you've heard, Bill Moyers is leaving. His program now is being cut back to half an hour a week. And even at that, they are countering his show with two new programs. One, Tucker Carlson's, and one, the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. Even the Wall Street Journal reporters would say this is one of the most right-wing, incendiary, ideological groups you could find. That's what they need to counter a cutback, Bill Moyers. We need to see more series like Chalmers Johnson has done. Chalmers Johnson taught at the University of California, Berkeley from 1962 to 1992, as well as the San Diego campus at University of California. His most recent book, Before the Sorrows of Empire, a superb book that taught us a great deal, taking that CIA term, making it the title of his book, Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. Let's hear the media interview the man who writes, "As distinct from other peoples on this earth, most Americans do not recognize or do not want to recognize that the United States dominates the world through its military power. Due to government secrecy, they're often ignorant of the fact that their government garrisons the globe. They do not realize that a vast network of American military bases on every continent except Antarctica actually constitutes a new form of empire." That's the opening paragraph of Chalmers' latest book, The Sorrows of Empire. Business Week reporting that by 2005, the U.S. military budget will exceed the combined military budgets of all other nations on Earth combined. Chalmers Johnson had an essay published last Sunday in the Los Angeles Times defining the military-industrial man, how our members of Congress are bought out by defense contractors who've created, quote, safe districts where they're guaranteed re-election. Well, with more voices like Chalmers, or simply Chalmers being amplified, I don't think those guarantees will last for long. Tonight, we'll sit back and listen to Chalmers Johnson and then do something about what he says. Professor Chalmers Johnson.
Thank you very, very much. It's an enormous pleasure to be here with Amy Goodman. I want to urge you, above all, to read her book. She's actually lucky to be alive, given what she did in Nigeria and in East Timor. Some extraordinary reporting, and is one of the great assets we have in the country today. I'd also just like to say that I'm enormously flattered to be invited by the Lannan Foundation. I didn't know about them. Now I do. I'm really very, very impressed by what they've done in the past. Heroes of mine like Nadine Gordimer has spoken here. That's a considerable challenge for me. It is fun to come back to Santa Fe, however. My wife and I have been coming here since 1969 to listen to the Santa Fe Opera. We were here in the summer of last year for the tribute to John Crosby, and it's wonderful to be back and credit what is almost surely the most important musical festival in America today. My topic tonight is the war in Iraq and the presidential election. Might as well, might as well get right on with it. The United States today faces a real crisis. It's not just the military failure of Bush's policies in Iraq or the discrediting of our armed forces and intelligence agencies as corrupt, incompetent, and criminal. It is above all our international isolation and disgrace because of our contempt for the rule of law. Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says in part, and I quote, "All treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land." The Geneva Conventions of 1949, covering the treatment of prisoners of war and civilians in wartime, are treaties the U.S. government promoted, signed, and ratified. They are therefore the supreme law of the land. Neither the President nor the Secretary of Defense has the authority to alter them or to choose whether or not to abide by them. President Bush's invention of such hitherto unknown categories as illegal combatant, evildoer, or most egregiously bad guy, and his claim of a unilateral right to imprison such persons indefinitely without charging them or giving them access to the courts and legal counsel is a usurpation of the Constitution. It is precisely why the United States should have ratified the treaty establishing the International Criminal Court, which is intended to deal not only with genuine terrorists and with people like Saddam Hussein, but also with the kinds of crimes President Bush and his administration have committed. The decision in late 2001 or early 2002, we don't know the exact date, by Bush, Condoleezza Rice, and Donald Rumsfeld to authorize a team of special forces operatives to secretly kidnap, torture, and execute al-Qaeda operatives anywhere in the world led to the systematic abuse of prisoners at Guantanamo, Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and Abu Ghraib in Baghdad. These are war crimes, now fully documented by Seymour Hersh in his recent book, Chain of Command. We finally understand what President Bush was referring to when in his 2003 State of the Union address, he said that some terrorism suspects who were not caught and brought to trial had been, quote, otherwise dealt with, and observed cryptically that more than 3,000 suspected terrorists have been arrested in many countries, and many others have met a different fate. I'm quoting, "Let's put it this way, they are no longer a problem to the United States and our friends and allies." This is the president bragging about being a murderer. Despite endless hypocrisy about how we have brought freedom to the people of Afghanistan and Iraq, we know that most citizens of those countries who've come into contact with our armed forces and survived have nonetheless had their lives ruined. I want to quote for a moment from the courageous, anonymous Iraqi woman who edits the internet blog called Baghdad Burning, subtitled Girl Blog from Iraq. I assure you, for those of you who are interested in following these affairs, I wouldn't fail to read her on any day. She wrote last May, I sometimes get emails asking me to, we don't know who she is, she's kept her identity quite secret. I sometimes get emails asking me to propose solutions, to make suggestions. Fine. Today's lesson, don't rape, don't torture, don't kill, and get out while you can, while it still looks like you have a choice. Chaos, civil war, we'll take our chances. Just take your puppets, your tanks, your smart weapons, your dumb politicians, your lies, your empty promises, your rapists, your sadistic torturers, and go. She's talking about our country. As I say, her reports on the internet at Riverbend Blog, blogspot.com, are indispensable to an understanding of the disaster we have made of a country that we invaded in the name of preventive war. Let me pursue Baghdad Burning just for a moment. In her message of September 15th, the author tells us how she spent September 11th, 2004, the third anniversary of what we call the start of the war on terrorism. She watched a pirated bootleg, a bootlegged CD of Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. She talks at length about the mother in the film who lost her son in Iraq and goes to Washington seeking sympathy, only to be met by mindless stares. Here's the way our anonymous reporter ends her dispatch, however. I thought, again, just a second, what Amy Goodman said. This is the sort of thing that should be in our so-called mainstream press. September 11th, he sat there reading the paper. As he reached out for the cup in front of him for a sip of tea, he could vaguely hear the sound of an airplane overhead. It was a bright, fresh day, and there was much he had to do, but the world suddenly went blank. Black. A colossal explosion, and then crushed bones under the weight of concrete and iron. Screams rose up around him, men, women, and children. Shards of glass sought out tender, unprotected skin. He thought of his family and tried to rise, but something inside of him was broken. There was a rising heat, and the pungent smell of burning flesh mingled sickeningly with the smoke and dust. And suddenly it was blackness. September 11th, 2001, New York World Trade Center? No. September 11th, 2004, Fallujah, an Iraqi home. Americans should understand that each so-called smart bomb the Pentagon drops on Baghdad civilians amounts to a blood debt, one that American civilians will probably ultimately have to pay. That is the meaning of the CIA's term blowback, retaliation for things done to foreigners by our government, though you should understand that it has a technical meaning. It means things that have been kept totally secret from the American public, so that when the retaliation comes, they have no way to put it in context or to understand cause and effect. One of the most flabbergasting failures of our democracy is that we recently impeached one president for what the Roman Catholic Church calls a venial sin, one that can be forgiven, while we ignore mountains of evidence of mortal sins by the current president, not least his sending the country to war based on a tissue of lies. One of the most catastrophic errors of the Bush administration was to abandon the policies of all previous American administrations to seek an equitable peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Bush instead unambiguously joined Ariel Sharon in his policies of expropriation and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. He did this largely out of domestic political considerations, plus the influence within his own government of Americans allied with the right wing of the Likud party. The result is that the United States has lost all credibility, influence, and trust in the entire Islamic world. In July this year, Zoghbi International Surveys polled 3,300 Arabs in Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. When asked to identify, quote, the best thing that comes to mind about America, virtually all respondents answered, nothing at all. In the year 2000, there were 1.3 billion Muslims worldwide, some 22% of the global population. Through our policies, we have turned virtually all of them against the United States. The point is that the torture scandals at Abu Ghraib prison, Chalabi Gate, CIA Director Tenet's resignation, war profiteering by Cheney's Halliburton Corporation, and other events have so discredited the United States that we have only the choice of getting out or being thrown out. We read daily in the establishment press that we must stay because of continuing terrorist attacks. But the evidence is mounting that such attacks are continuing because the U.S. forces remain in Iraq. We may call Muqtada al-Sadr a terrorist, but his supporters see themselves as engaged in a war of national liberation against easily identified foreign invaders who came to Iraq to steal the country's resources. The Iraq War is very possibly the most serious self-inflicted wound in the history of American foreign policy. It was caused by American imperialism and militarism, which are the subjects of my book, The Sorrows of Empire. The subtitle is important: Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Let me try to make clear what I mean by imperialism and militarism in a very short period of time. According to the Pentagon's annual inventory of real estate, its so-called base structure report, we have over 725 military bases in some 132 countries around the world. This vast network of American bases constitutes a new form of empire, an empire of military enclaves rather than of colonies, as in older forms of imperialism. Our military deploys well over 500,000 soldiers, spies, technicians, teachers, dependents, and civilian contractors in other nations. To dominate the oceans and seas of the world, we maintain some 12 carrier task forces, which constitute floating bases. We operate numerous espionage bases, not included in the base structure report, to monitor what the people of the world, including our own citizens, are saying, faxing, or emailing to one another. In fact, one of the most interesting things about the base structure report, every time it comes out, is what isn't in it. For example, all of the bases in Britain that are disguised as Royal Air Force bases are never mentioned in the base structure report. We know about them primarily because of a woman I greatly admire, Lindis Percy, of the Committee for Nuclear Disarmament. She makes a career out of breaking into Royal Air Force bases. She's invariably arrested and tried for criminal trespass, but before they go to court, the U.S. Embassy invariably calls and asks that the charges be dropped. They do not want Miss Percy to be talking about that. She was last seen when the boy emperor visited London last November. She was the one up on the ladder hanging the American flag upside down on the gate of Buckingham Palace. I'm just putting in a plug for this. I don't know her at all, but I certainly greatly admire her. This is a serious protester. Our installations abroad bring huge profits to civilian industries, which design and manufacture weapons for the armed forces, or like the now well-publicized Kellogg Brown and Root Company, a subsidiary of the Halliburton Corporation of Houston, undertake contract services to build and maintain our outposts. One task of such contractors is to keep uniformed members of the Imperium housed in comfortable quarters, well-fed, amused, and supplied with enjoyable, affordable vacation facilities. As an official with Kellogg Brown and Root put it, we do everything but pull the trigger. In Iraq, there is evidence that they also do a little bit of that. Service in our armed forces is no longer an obligation of citizenship, as it was back in 1953 when I was in the Navy. Since 1973, it has been a career choice, one often made by citizens trying to escape from one or another dead end of our society. That is why African Americans are twice as well represented in the Army as they are in our population, and why 50% of the women in the armed forces are from minorities. Army PFC Jessica Lynch, who was wounded at Nasiriyah during the assault on Baghdad, when asked by the media why she joined the Army, she replied, "I couldn't get a job at Walmart in Palestine, West Virginia. I joined the Army to get out of my hometown." When she was recruited, she was also told that as a supply clerk, she wouldn't be shot at. Today, we have a professional permanent standing Army, plus its array of privately outsourced services that costs around $750 billion a year. That is about $750 billion. This amount includes the annual Defense Department appropriation for weapons and salaries, stands right now at slightly over $425 billion. Plus another $75 billion, actually the number's probably $10 billion higher than that, for Iraq and Afghanistan, $20 billion for nuclear weapons in the Department of Energy, and at least $200 billion in pensions and disability payments for our veterans. It is, I think, something also that's not been reported. The casualties are mounting highly, particularly from the use of depleted uranium ammunition. Fully one-third of General Schwarzkopf's army from the first Persian Gulf War I have now applied for veterans benefits. That's 30%. It's a huge cost that we're incurring of wounded. We're not actually paying for these expenses, but putting them on the tab, since we are today running the largest governmental and trade deficits in modern economic history. Our militarism threatens us with bankruptcy. In my book, I devote the final chapter to the likely consequences of our imperialism and militarism. These are, in rough terms, perpetual war, the end of the republic, official lying and disinformation, and bankruptcy. I try to go into detail on each, documenting how advanced they are in our society and whether their corrosive effects have now become irreversible. My intent is to mobilize inattentive citizens to information that I know they don't have, because our government does everything in its power to see that they don't, but that they need if they are not to lose our republic and the civil liberties it defends. Which brings me then, controversially of course, to the candidacy of John Kerry. I understand why many people are alarmed by Kerry's attempt to outdo Bush in military machismo, and I confess to being disquieted ever since he stepped up to the microphone at the Democratic Convention in Boston, saluted, and said, reporting for duty. A Spanish-speaking friend recently quoted to me the old Argentine saying, es la misma mierda con menos olor, or obviously there's, in this audience there are people who know what this means, the same old crap but with less smell. Don't get me wrong, I'm a China specialist and this is the year of the monkey. I'd vote for a monkey against the current incumbent. So let me ask, rhetorically perhaps, whether and how the decline and fall of the American Republic could be averted under a Kerry presidency. The case for Kerry consists of 4 points. I have torn my Howard Dean bumper strips off the car. truth in advertising. First, he's not a chicken hawk. It's a scandal that, with the exception of Colin Powell, every single civilian leader of our government, from the president on down, has no experience of either war or barracks life, and that the vice president obtained 6 deferments to avoid service in Vietnam. When married men with children were ordered deferred, Dick Cheney and his wife had a daughter, she's a very important daughter, by the way, but had a daughter 9 months and a day later. The Attorney General, John Ashcroft, obtained 7 deferments to avoid serving. Kerry has a distinguished record of military service. This is important today when the military establishment is easily the largest and most expensive element of the executive branch. Second, Kerry's role as a member and advocate of Vietnam veterans against the war is one of the most honorable aspects of his background. It is a tragedy. It is a tragedy that we've become so militaristic that in order to be elected, he must disown the courageous stand he took 35 years ago. This reflects one of the major differences between our military during the Vietnam War and our military today. Then it was a citizens' army. Members of the armed forces were a democratic check on militarism because they were not volunteers, but draftees. They were naturally concerned with the purposes of the war, how it would end, and whether their government and officers were lying to them. Today, with a professional military, people who serve in it have a vested interest in advancing their careers through armed conflict. I think we're unlikely to see in Iraq veterans against the war, although once the consequences of depleted uranium ammunition on their lives become fully apparent, this may change. Actually, the consequences are so awful, they would be better to have died in combat. Third, a Kerry administration will be a check on the rampant secrecy upon which our militarism thrives. Given his 19 years of service in the Senate, he has the knowledge to end much of the secrecy that covers up the destruction of the environment, the deployment of weapons in outer space, our refusal to conserve fossil fuels, and many other scandals. Last year, the U.S. government classified more than 14 million new national security secrets, up from 11 million in the previous year and 8 million the year before. Ending the secrecy surrounding the Department of Defense and the intelligence agencies would be one of the most effective ways to restore democratic controls over them. Had the public known that the Bush administration was using false intelligence to shift the war away from al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to Iraq in order to serve a private agenda, it would surely have stopped it. Fourth, the main issue in the coming election is the Constitution and the need to restore its integrity as the supreme law of the land. It was concern over violations of the Constitution that energized the Howard Dean campaign. Kerry will at least end the tenure of John Ashcroft and end the secret abuse of prisoners in federal prisons in Iraq and at Guantanamo Bay. If we're lucky, he might even close the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, which. What we do there is to instruct military officers from Latin America in state terrorism. For those even slightly interested in human rights, a Kerry victory is indispensable. Having said all this, let me nonetheless acknowledge that the political system may not be capable of saving the United States as we know it. It is hard to imagine that any president of either party could stand up to the powerful vested interests surrounding the Pentagon and the secret intelligence agencies. Given that 40% of the defense budget is secret, and all of the intelligence agencies' budgets are secret, it is impossible for Congress to do effective oversight of them, even if it wanted to. This is not something that started with the Bush administration. The Defense Department's black budgets go back to the Manhattan Project of World War II to build atomic bombs right here in New Mexico. The amounts spent on the intelligence agencies have been secret ever since the CIA was created in 1947. The stipulation in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7 of the Constitution that, and I quote, a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time, unquote, that has not been true in our country for more than 50 years. Empires do not last, and their ends are usually unpleasant. Americans like me, born before World War II, have personal knowledge, in some cases personal experience, of the collapse of at least seven empires. Those of Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, Great Britain, France, the Netherlands, Portugal, and the Soviet Union. If one includes all of the 20th century, three more major empires came tumbling down: the Chinese, Austro-Hungarian, and Ottoman. A combination of imperial overstretch, rigid economic institutions, and an inability to reform weakened all of these empires, leaving them fatally vulnerable in the face of disastrous wars, many of which the empires themselves started. There is no reason to think that an American empire will not go the same way and for the same reasons. I believe that if our Republican form of government is to be saved, it will be as a result of an upsurge of direct democracy. In the spring of last year, 2003, before our troops were launched into Iraq, some 10 million people in all the genuine democracies on earth demonstrated against the war, against George Bush, and for democracy. These included the largest demonstrations in British history, 2 million people in London, but also 400,000 people in New York City, 1 million each in Berlin, in Madrid, it's important, and in Rome. The first victory of this movement came on March 14th of this year with the election of Spanish Prime Minister José Zapatero. If democracy means anything at all, it means that public opinion matters. Zapatero understood that 80% of the Spanish people opposed Bush's war against Iraq, and he immediately withdrew all Spanish forces. It's a great pity that Kerry criticized Zapatero for this. People need to duplicate the Spanish victory in Tony Blair's Britain, Silvio Berlusconi's Italy, Junichiro Koizumi's Japan, John Howard's Australia, and above all, in our own country. What should a President Kerry do first? Obviously, the first thing is to withdraw our army of crusaders from Iraq. We have to recognize that the 1st Marine Division does not have the mandate of heaven to bestow on Iraq, and the longer we wait, the worse the final debacle will be. The next thing to do is to start reconstructing a constitutional foreign policy. This means, among other things, enabling the Congress to exercise genuine oversight over the Department of Defense and the intelligence agencies by declassifying everything except for truly operational details. A constitutional foreign policy also means ending the encroachments of the uniformed military on the civilian formulation and administration of our foreign policy. Abolishing the system of regional military commands that have usurped the roles of our ambassadors. Terminating the Department of Defense's black budgets and publicizing details of the intelligence agency's budgets as the 9/11 Commission has recommended. Enforcing the antitrust laws against the military-industrial complex, and firing any Secretary of Defense who again claims the right personally to decide what prisoners, what citizens or foreigners are covered by the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners and civilians. These items are just a start. I intend to vote for Kerry. I recognize that George Bush is probably 100% bad news. Kerry is just 80% bad news. But it looks like we could use the 20% right now. I believe he's the only electable politician in America who might, like Zapatero in Spain, pay attention to public opinion. If we can demonstrate that a majority of the American people want peace, I believe and hope that John Kerry will heed the call. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Yeah.
Well, this is interesting. You know, tomorrow is the first presidential, I don't think we can call it debate. I think when someone on television today, the two presidential presentations, because they won't be debating each other. There are cameras here. In that case, they are not allowed to show the reaction shot of the other person to ensure that there's no actually direct interaction between the two candidates. And we have a clock right here that's facing us, but theirs will be facing out to humiliate either side if they dare go beyond the time. Well, Chalmers, I wanted to start out by asking you how, if you think Iraq compares to Vietnam.
The terrifying thing about it is that it's occurring again. That is, that we don't have the news, that the system isn't working the way it ought to, that we have seen the subversion of the intelligence service then and again today. I think they're very, very similar, and they raise that extremely disturbing aspect of how ignorant the public is of the world we live in, of what we do in these countries, and that it's enough to make you wonder. Contrary to Churchill, who said that all systems of government were lousy except democracy was simply the least worst, you begin to wonder, do we have a democracy? Is there really a choice? Does this make any sense right now? That's why I worry about whether we have, in fact, already crossed our own Rubicon, and it is irreversible. But I think it's very similar to Vietnam, and except that it's more serious now even than that was.
As we walked around the Republican convention, and one evening we walked with Arundhati Roy, took her on the floor of the convention. Her comment afterwards, it was like 1,000 Barbie dolls with one head. But, I mean, I would say a big difference between the Democratic and Republican conventions was that there's a true, it seemed like love that was expressed by many of the Republican delegates towards Bush. I mean, reverence, love. Even the most devoted Kerry advocates and delegates did not express anything like that. But I wanted to go back and look at Vietnam to compare that kind of devotion and also go to your own past. Because at that time, you were very much an advocate. You were at UC Berkeley, massive protest, but you were on the other side. You were working with the U.S. government. Can you talk about your transformation?
John Maynard Keynes once said, when somebody challenged him with being inconsistent, when I get new information, I change my position. What, sir, do you do with new information? Let me just say, I've in print acknowledged that I believe I was wrong on the protests against the Vietnam War and that I would have preferred to stand with the protesters. At the same time, I would want to mention that I think people have forgotten there was a lot more going on at the time of the Vietnam War than just Vietnam. I was teaching at Berkeley at the time, taught a large course in the theory of revolution in which I had numerous, many of them I've kept in contact with, members of the Black Panther Party. black protest was, as far as my wife and I were concerned, the more important issue. That made us into supporters of Lyndon Johnson. In my lifetime, the most important legislation in our country was not legislated. It was done by our dictators, and that was one man, one vote. And it couldn't have been done by the Congress. It had to be done by the Supreme Court. That in the case of Vietnam, I made one trip to Saigon in 1962. I concluded that it was a civil war and that we shouldn't get involved. I wrote an article saying that. But then I made the classic error, many people are making again today, that having gotten involved, we in the United States couldn't afford to lose, that it was too costly. Also, I was then the chairman of the Center for Chinese Studies at Berkeley. I was very much caught up in the sort of technical issues of China and communism. I concluded that I probably knew more about communism than I did about our own government. And the Sino-Soviet dispute was very much an issue at the time. I was recruited by Richard Helms, then the director of Central Intelligence, very shortly after that to be indicted and convicted for lying to Congress on the, one of our leaders, on the issue of did we overthrow Salvador Allende in 1973 in Chile. Of course we did. He denied it. But at the same time, this was in the old Office of National Estimates of CIA. I was interested in China, and at that time, they knew more about it than the people on the campuses. That was the world of campus Maoism. I was myself increasingly convinced the Chinese Revolution was turning into a Herodian horror story, namely the Cultural Revolution was going badly off the tracks. In retrospect, I think I should have stood with the war protest. Oh, there was also, I think, another issue, small, but maybe not totally unimportant. I started at the University of California, Berkeley, back in 1949 as Joe Freshman at $32 a semester. That was nice. I'm one of the few people that they ever hired there who came from the university. The chancellor once said to me, you're a man without imagination. You came to the university and you never left. You ended up chairman of your own department. But partly, I think, at the time of the protests, it was a class thing. I believed that the protesters were rich brats who were attacking the University of California in a way that I didn't like. And I once made a little test. I went into the library to look at all the books on Vietnamese communism, and every one of them were there. I thought, these guys aren't reading. They don't know what they're talking about. They really don't know what they're talking about. I've had any number of graduate students of mine to come back to tell me how wrong I was on this issue. So I acknowledge it.
So you were on the inside at the time when people like Daniel Ellsberg was changing, was shifting. What effect did his publishing The Secrets of the Pentagon
I remember it well.
Have on you and your colleagues?
Dan Ellsberg was the easiest person on earth, I know him reasonably well, to have given a security clearance to. After all, he was a Harvard PhD in economics, a RAND Corporation intellectual, a Marine Corps officer with combat experience in Vietnam. As we used to say, he was one of us. I mean, he was one of us. And on the day that the Pentagon Papers began to be published in the New York Times, there was literally cheering in the halls of the Central Intelligence Agency on grounds that finally we will not look like the fools that we are portrayed as being. We have been saying this war was unwinnable to McNamara and to Lyndon Johnson for a long time. They've not paid attention, refused to acknowledge it. Ellsberg says today that the thing that bothers him most is how long it took him to make the decision to start revealing the stuff that he had worked on. I think today we're seeing the effects of his great precedent on people like the very important Colonel Kitakovsky, the woman within the Near Eastern section of the Pentagon who's come out and gone into detail on the disastrous planning for this war. Richard Clark, not a person I particularly admire, but he certainly has told us a great deal we didn't know about particularly Clinton administration activities against Al-Qaeda, and they were much more effective than anything this administration has ever done. And there are quite a few others of them out there now today, too, I think inspired by the very important precedent of Dan Ellsberg. He risked the rest of his life in jail.
Tell us about these national intelligence estimates. One has just come out where President Bush said the CIA was just guessing, where he was clearly warned that this would give rise to much more political Islam and civil war in Iraq.
Well, let me be just as candid about it as I can. The Central Intelligence Agency was created by the National Security Act of 1947 explicitly to prevent surprise attack on the United States. That was its function. It was to prevent another Pearl Harbor. Unfortunately, that has not been the case since it was created. That he's been overwhelmed by clandestine activities within the organization, reflecting William Donovan's commitment during the Office of Strategic Services during World War II, that Franklin Roosevelt was a great supporter of. But every president since Harry Truman, once he came into office and discovered that he had at his disposal a private army, unaccountable and answerable to no one but himself, no president has ever failed to use it. It is a huge temptation. It vastly upstages, that is, the career patterns within the agency are entirely to people in clandestine services. Easily the biggest instance of blowback ever was 9/11/2001, and it directly came from the largest clandestine operation we ever carried out, namely the recruiting, arming, and sending into battle of the Mujahideen Islamic militants in Afghanistan in the 1980s. They came back to pay us back after when the Soviet Union withdrew in 1988, and we just simply lost interest in Afghanistan and saw it descend into one of the most hopeless civil wars of modern times. People who were, in CIA jargon, at one time assets, Osama bin Laden, pious young Saudi millionaire, who was supporting our efforts, turned against us. And they never made much of a secret about it. They've been paying us back since the blowing up of the Air Force barracks at Dairan, Saudi Arabia, the attacks on our embassies in East Africa in 1998, the attack on the USS Cole in 2000. All of these were things done by Osama bin Laden. And there's without question what he achieved on September 11th, 2001, to use Pentagon jargon, is the greatest instance of asymmetric warfare in the history of international relations. Mm-hmm. Asymmetric warfare is actually a much better word for it than terrorism. Terrorism is a pejorative term used basically for propaganda purposes. Asymmetric warfare is to... it's David and Goliath. It's a judo match. It's use the weapons of the powerful against them.
You talk about Kissinger.
I mean, it's terrorism. There's no question. The attack in New York was terrorism. I'm not absolutely certain the attack on the Pentagon constitutes terrorism. That's warfare. That's a legitimate target. That is, there weren't any innocent bystanders in the Pentagon. There may have been some innocent bystanders on American Airlines, but not in the Pentagon.
There was... One of the people who died at the Pentagon was Craig Amundsen. His wife, Amber Amundsen, is... the woman who walked from the Pentagon up to New York with other survivors. He was a graphic designer there, and mm-hmm. he had this bumper sticker in his car that said World Peace. And when she got to Union Square, there was a picture of her in the Times, and she wanted to reclaim the flag. She was against war and retaliation, and she always wore the flag as a shawl. the New York Times did not mention that this was a peace protest. They just had a picture of her wrapped in the American flag and said one of those who lost their loved ones in the September 11th attacks.
Yeah. After 9/11, my wife was in Europe, and I spent days alone looking at TV until I finally CNN got on my nerves so badly I've not watched it since. But but I remember the pictures I thought were the most tragic I'd ever seen in the United States. Were American women standing in Lower Manhattan holding up photographs of sons, brothers, husbands, whatever. And finally, as I was staring at these pictures, it, of course, dawned on me that I'd seen these before. These were the desaparecidos, in Chile, in Argentina, under Operation Condor, we had placed in power military regimes that... they knew full well what had happened to their sons and husbands, but they had to invent a new word in Spanish for it because they couldn't. They would have themselves been arrested if they'd used the accurate term. There are many images, obviously, from that period that come to mind. But asymmetric warfare is attacks on the innocent and to draw attention, or attacks on the vulnerable. In order to draw attention to the crimes of the invulnerable.
In your book, Sorrows of Empire, you talk about the bases around the world, something that many people don't realize, this realignment that's taking place. Can you talk about some of the countries whose militaries are being shored up right now and the countries that are paying the price for not supporting the U.S. in the invasion of Iraq?
Oh, well, in the so-called realignment that's going on right now, that Douglas Feith, the number three in the Pentagon, is the person in charge of it, this is largely retaliation against Germany and South Korea because of their failure to support us in the attack on Baghdad. South Korea is today probably the most anti-American genuine democracy on Earth. It has 101 American military bases in it. That's why. The only other country I can think of that might be equally anti-American, oddly enough, is Greece. Most Americans don't remember the Greek colonels between 1967 and 1973, placed in power by the CIA, probably the most odious regime created by either side throughout the Cold War. No Greek will ever forget it. We saw signs of it during the Athens Olympics of expressions of anti-American sentiment that were to be expected. But I think the realignment right now is largely fake. You don't see, we're not talking about the ones we're opening. 14 permanent bases are being built by Kellogg-Brenner route right now in Iraq. We didn't have an exit strategy from Iraq because we didn't intend to leave. And that's started to catch up with us now. But it's an extremely complex business. In Japan, which is, if Tony Blair is our poodle, then Koizumi is our cocker spaniel. They'll do anything they can to follow in George Bush's footsteps. The 91 American bases in Japan are maintained only because the Japanese public wouldn't tolerate the 3rd Marine Division and the troops that we have in Japan if they were located near big cities like Yokohama or Tokyo or something of that sort. Therefore, they're stuck down in Okinawa. Okinawa is a Japanese equivalent of Puerto Rico. It's a place that was acquired. A quite different culture, acquired in the late 19th century, always discriminated against by mainland Japanese. It was, that's when I, probably in some ways, one of the issues that led me to write Blowback was, many of you will have forgotten, but on September 4th, 1995, two Marines and a sailor from our bases in Okinawa abducted, beat, and raped a 12-year-old girl. It set off the largest demonstrations against the United States since the security treaty was signed. Interesting enough, the commander of American forces in Japan at the time was General Richard Myers, who is today, of course, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who used the same argument then, 3 bad apples. It's now gone up to about 12 bad apples, but we're building you know, we're creating orchards of bad apples around the world. The argument was, of course, that it was not our this was not typical of the American Armed Forces or of the situation of military bases located in amidst very heavily concentrated civilian population, whereas based on my own research, on the research of Okinawan women act against military violence, of the Okinawan Prefectural Police, of a couple of really brilliant investigative reporters at the Dayton Daily News, which is covers Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, we can now demonstrate that the rate of sexually violent crimes leading to court-martial, that is, it means the woman came forward, pressed charges, in Okinawa has been running now for 50 years at 2 per month. And that's true this last month. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of costs that these bases incur.
Can you explain how U.S. soldiers are protected?
Well, one of the most complex devices that we impose on any country when we establish military bases is a status of forces agreement. The treaty or agreement between the governments establishing these bases are usually open, easily found, and publicized. Status of forces agreements are largely classified or simply you can't get one. To read the status of forces agreement in Japan in Japanese, it makes it almost unintelligible. But this goes into the details on if our armed forces commit crimes against local civilians, who gets jurisdiction over them? In Europe, there's no question they're turned over to Europeans. The Germans long ago established that. In East Asia, there are very complex issues involved before the Japanese get to deal with them. You saw that just in mid-August, an American Marine helicopter from Futenma Marine Corps Air Station in Okinawa crashed into the buildings of Okinawa International University. It was loaded with depleted uranium ammunition. Our Marines showed up at once, surrounded the place with machine guns, prevented the police from investigating it. This has created great outrage throughout Japan, but it was defensible under the Status of Forces Agreement that in case of an accident, we will take charge. These bases are American extraterritorial. They're colonies in the sense that generally speaking, in East Asia particularly, the host country has no say at all over what goes on there. That's not true in Germany, where there are a very large number of military bases. There, the German police can enter any military base they want to at any time in searching for an American charge for the crime. That's not true in any of the East Asian bases. It's a form of extraterritoriality, very much like the world of 19th century China, which we, after the Opium War, we were the ones who inaugurated the policy that Chinese law was thought to be barbaric. In the phrase of Daniel Webster, no white man should be subjected to such barbarian law. Therefore, we wrote into all of our treaties with China that in case an American committed a crime in Shanghai, he would be turned over to American consular officials and tried using American law rather than Chinese law.
Isn't that similar to the International Criminal Court?
Yes.
We say it's fine for them, but
precisely,
not for U.S. officials or U.S. soldiers.
Exactly.
Protect people.
The International Criminal Court was one of the great modern achievements of international law, and it is scandalous that we didn't just refuse to ratify it. George Bush has decided to retroactively de-sign it, as you know. Clinton actually signed it, but then we've actively worked against it's coming into force, whereas there are immense protections in it against what we're claiming that there would be the use of political prosecutions against Americans. What's happened in Abu Ghraib and what has been revealed in the Takuba report and things like that simply cry out for International Criminal Court cases being brought because of the failure of the United States to do it or the fakery of the Pentagon investigations.
Mm-hmm. As an expert in Japan,
specialist,
General Powell putting pressure, the U.S. government putting pressure on Japan to change its constitution,
yes,
to militarize if they want to be a part of the U.N. Security Council. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes. It's Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. Japan formally renounces the use of military power in international relations. It is extremely important.
Did the U.S. write that?
Yes, and the U.S. wrote it.
After World War II.
Douglas MacArthur put it in, into the Constitution. But it then very quickly became an element of Japanese popular national pride. I think the reason is, and it's never fully understood in this country, the Germans were had long been acknowledged that they apologized repeatedly, monetarily, and in numerous ways for crimes committed against their victims during World War II. It has long been charged that Japan did not do so, did not offer the same kinds of apologies. The circumstances are different in that, of course, the nations that Germany victimized were directly on its borders, whereas Japan is an island power. Many people in East Asia have regarded Article 9 as, in fact, the apology. That is, that the Japanese actually did apologize. They did say that we renounced the use of belligerency in international affairs. And I think it's even if it has only symbolic importance, Japan today probably has the world's third largest defense budget, and it's a very powerful country. The symbolism is important. We have been pressuring the Japanese repeatedly, Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, to modify their constitution and get rid of Article 9. I think it is an outrageous interference in their affairs, but also a short-sighted, well, it is militarism. I mean, that's, General Powell still likes to call himself general. I don't honestly think he knows what diplomacy adds up to. What diplomats are people that are beyond ideology. They are supposed to not go in and give sermons about what we believe in, but to see if you can find any common ground. That's they're like Jesuit priests allowed to read books on the index. We trust them to do the job. Powell is not a diplomat in that sense. He's a general, and he still likes to call himself general. And I think that this will turn out badly, of what we are doing today, in that there is a rising head of nationalism in Japan, whereas, of course, you're dealing with the emergence just across the North China Sea of a genuine superpower. China is now easily the world's fastest-growing large country. Without any empirical investigation, I can guarantee you that at least three-quarters of this audience is sitting in underwear manufactured in China. I mean, that's where it comes from. Anything on Earth today can be manufactured in China cheaper than it can anywhere else. It is, one of the other complicating issues of the Republican Party. They're hopelessly split between the neocons in the Pentagon and the Fortune 500. That are heavily invested in China. China is the third largest recipient of foreign direct investment after only Britain and the United States of any nation on earth. The prime minister, the foreign minister of China, I'm sure, is much more interested in the vice president of Boeing for international affairs than he is in anybody in Washington, D.C.
And what role is China playing in Iraq?
China has found Iraq useful to them, in that it's taken the pressure off coming from the neocons, from Wolfowitz and Condi, Wolfie, Rummy, and company, that is in their original documents, all stated that the policy that they began to enunciate in 1992 was that the United States now, as a new Rome, as a colossus athwart the world, could not allow the development of any form of competing power, not necessarily threatening power, competing power anywhere on earth. And of course, the first nation they identified was China. The war in Iraq and the disastrous course it has taken has distracted the country from China. And the Chinese are very pleased with that. They've also used the war in Iraq to continue to pressure national minorities in China, such as the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, the Tibetans, and things of this sort, without gaining much attention around the world at all. And they continue to grow. I mean, the main thing I would say, though, is that the United States today is simply anachronistic in East Asia. We still believe that the answers to the problems are cruise missiles, carrier task forces, whereas commerce is breaking out. the Chinese are easily the most materialist people on earth. I mean, actually now is their Marxist moment, not under Mao Zedong. Mao Zedong was an idealist. Now they really are believing that getting rich is fun. My goddaughter is a Brazilian woman. She's been living in Shanghai the past few years studying Chinese. She doesn't know anything about the revolution. She just thinks this is big, wonderful Shanghai. And it really is. That's what we're not adjusting to. That I think much of East Asia sees us as anachronistic today, that we are not figuring out how we are going to adjust to a new Chinese superpower. I used to live in Hong Kong. The old Hong Kong joke was that China just had a couple of bad centuries and it's back. it's back. And you've got to adjust. If you go to war with them, you'll lose it. On Churchill's famous Battle of Britain remark, if you've got to go, take one with you. Well, if every American takes one Chinese with you, there's still 500 million of them left. So they win.
We have to wrap up, want to ask about the whole ABB philosophy, anything but Bush.
Yes.
The idea that the Democratic candidate, if John Kerry were to win, that on November 3rd, that they would simply be more open to change, changing direction, to changing what's going on right now in Iraq, that there's a kind of silencing going on, saying, raise the questions later. Mm-hmm. But what kind of mandate will he think he has if people don't start raising issues now? In fact, I really do think after what happened at the Republican convention, this mass protest, most of the signs there were not John Kerry signs. They were simply against war and they're against the Bush agenda. But what about the role right now in this critical month that people should play if they are deeply concerned not only about what George Bush is saying and doing, but a sort of paler version of him, John Kerry?
In all candor, you're the one to answer this. You've been covering it so well for so long, and so brilliantly, really. I mean, you really have, and I'm certainly not just sitting here saying the obvious to you. Certainly, you vote for Kerry because you're concerned about the Supreme Court, Roe versus Wade, the environment, and a few things like that. On international affairs, it's perfectly possible that he could be worse. He could be vulnerable on these issues. Novak has told us that the president, Bush, is actually plotting a cut and run very quickly after they first try a really Carthaginian strategy of killing an awful lot of people in these cities that are now, the military seems to be demanding one last effort, which would be a disaster if they undertake it. But that is precisely why I'm worried about whether or not we are not succumbing in exactly the same way that the Roman Republic did. That is, many of our precedents, certainly in the way our government was created, the separation of powers, things of that sort, came from the Roman Republic. It succumbed to, it created inadvertently and thoughtlessly an empire around the Mediterranean, and then discovered that it required a very large standing army in order to keep it under its control. This led to militarism and ended I used to admire the Roman Republic. They had conscription, but they only conscripted rich farmers, people who had a stake in the society. They didn't use slaves or plebeians in the early Roman legions. It was only as time went on that then you slowly began to have the rise within Roman society of military populace, people like Julius Caesar, who had, after all, then had the highest rank in the land. He was consul. Who are increasingly determined to support the military and the military way of life in return for simply one thing, life dictatorship. Caesar was, of course, assassinated in the greatest tyrannicide of all time, 44 BC, in the Roman Senate, but that soon gave way then to a genuinely ruthless man, Octavian, who became the god Augustus Caesar and instituted what we politely call the Roman Republic, but it was in fact a military dictatorship. And that's certainly, after writing this, Wesley Clark entered the race, you know, and I thought, oh my God, it's happening faster than I thought. Here's a guy who's has no known civilian influences at all, first in his class at West Point, NATO commander, things of that sort. What happened with the demise of the Roman Republic and the loss of the very, very, I mean, it's the first great experiment in democracy, and it lasted two centuries. That's about our record, about where we are today. It didn't lead to good government. That after Augustus, you got Tiberius, who withdrew to Capri with a covey of small boys to play with his sexual interests. This gave way, as I remember correctly, to Caligula, a genuine madman, which gave way to Claudius. Claudius, his wife poisoned him with a poisoned mushroom in order to bring her son by an earlier marriage to power as the Roman emperor. That was Nero. For those of you who are Christians, you will remember him. He was extremely unpleasant to some early important Christians. But that is to say, that's what we're risking. I mean, if you ask me how the American Republic will end, I fear it will end in the public, as in the case of the Roman public, finally giving power to the military as a way of ending the strife generated in the society. The Roman Empire did last for three centuries. Now the end of empires is coming with the speed of FedEx. It took three centuries to get rid of the old one. But I fear Cassandra was the only social scientist who ever was right. There was something in that horse. Beware of Greeks bearing gifts. I'm sounding like Cassandra on this subject, but the signs are all there. And just as you said, the election is fake. It is not really offering us a choice. The debate will not give us a discussion of what, as a nation, we are doing to Iraq, to other places on earth, in Palestine. That is a failure of democracy. I'm sorry to say.
A note of hope at the end?
A note of hope? Well, I think the note of hope was, as I tried to say, it was probably Jose Zapatero. That is the thing that, again, if democracy does mean anything at all, and you can argue about precisely what it does mean, but it certainly does mean that public opinion matters. Right now in Britain, in the United States, in Italy, in Japan, in Australia, public opinion doesn't matter. The government is doing what it wants to do, contrary to public opinion. That's a serious problem. But that I believe if we could produce the sorts of demonstrations that existed last year, or the women's demonstrations in Washington in April, huge demonstrations, or the ones that, as you mentioned, occurred in New York during the Republican convention, these create facts that I believe we could expect a figure like Kerry to respond to pay attention to. In lieu of that, then I have to admit I'm not terribly optimistic, though my wife keeps saying, you cannot end these things anymore by saying, if you've got any little money ahead, now's the time to think about a condo in Vancouver. start preparing your escape route. If you were young with a couple of children instead of 73 years old, you might start looking around and think, what languages do we know in this family? You should always beware of pundits who claim that we're, at a turning point. But every once in a while, the world surprises you, and we are at a turning point. This one looks like we won't have to wait too long to find out how it's going. Pardon me? Well, again, another bit of the fakery. That is, we're not, but it's not just the voting and how we vote. It's also the jurisdictions that we have. I'm deadly tired of having our politics determined by New Hampshire and Iowa. I wrote about my own district in the Los Angeles Times last Sunday, as Amy mentioned, it's the 50th Congressional District of California, where we've been represented for the last 14 years by a guy called Randy Duke Cunningham. He's a wholly bought and paid for tool of the military-industrial complex. His biggest contributors are the Titan Corporation of San Diego. Some of their employees, as you know, have been charged with being torturers at Abu Ghraib prison. By Lockheed Martin, the world's largest munitions firm, General Dynamics. It reads like a list of the weapons makers. And he's thought to have a safe district. Since I've published this, I've received letters from all over the country, people saying, you've just described my district. That's the way things are. Under these circumstances, as you said, there is not a pressure or an impulse toward reform. We don't even have a Mikhail Gorbachev who is out there making the case that the Soviet Union is coming apart if we don't begin to do something about it. We're instead going blithely onward, not paying attention. But that's, let me simply conclude by saying that's certainly not Amy Goodman's fault. She has done. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to the Lannan Foundation. Thank you to Chalmers Johnson, who's bought by no one. And remember, it really is all up to you. So now go out and do something. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.